Never Mind, I Stopped My Train by Martin Sorrell. Martin Jarvis and Joanna Myers recount the events of July the 18th, 1898, and the heroic efforts of Walter Peart and Harry Dean, employees of the Great Western Railway.
The Times, Tuesday, the 19th of July, 1898. Accident on the Great Western Railway. Whilst the 4:15 Great Western Express from Windsor to Paddington was passing between Ealing and Acton yesterday, the connecting rod broke and the boiler was torn out of the engine. Both driver and engineman were thrown onto the line and horribly scalded and mutilated. They are not expected to live.
That newspaper report got it partly right. There was indeed a horrific explosion on the engine of the 4:15. The boiler was torn apart. And because of the massive backdraft created in a speeding steam locomotive, the contents of superheated steam and water rushed back through the firebox and onto the footplate. The two men would have just had time to leap to the back of their cab. They were not, in fact, thrown onto the line. Instead, remarkably, they kept their nerve and fought their way back through the steam and flames to the controls. They wrestled with the brake, the regulator handle, the reversing gear, until they got the train under control and sensed that it was coming to a halt. Then, and only then, did they jump off, or rather stagger off, the footplate. By that time, they'd been virtually burnt alive. They fell onto the side of the track, semi-conscious and delirious, until help arrived.
The papers of the day were full of verses penned to mark the gallantry of the two men. Canon H.D. Rawmsley provided this contribution in the Daily News.
Now let the tear involuntary start. When that fierce fire drake only you could tame, spat in your faces all its wrath and flame, because it was self-wounded to the heart. Blind, burnt beyond imaginable smart, you shut the valves and to a standstill came. Once nameless, both now evermore with name, you dared to play the hero's part.
Once nameless, these two heroes rapidly became famous across the country and beyond during that summer of 1898. Driver Walter Peart and engine man Harry Dean. Walter, a neat and slightly mournful-looking man, dressed like no locoman today, in crisp buttoned-up white shirt, tie and lapelled jacket. His wavy hair nicely parted, plus his full trim beard, make him look rather more than his 42 years. Not patrician exactly, but dignified and serious, like the sailor on the old player's cigarette packets.
Harry Dean does look his age. He's only 25. Like Walter, like all Great Western engine men of the time, he's well turned out in his three-piece suit, looking as if he's off to an interview. Harry's short haircut and his carefully shaped moustache give him almost a trendy 1980s feel. Both men look serious and dependable. Both would have been in their right place on one of Her Majesty's naval destroyers, cutting sharply through the Solent, standing in the wheelhouse, back straight, eyes steady.
London, and the Great Western Railway's running sheds at Westbourne Park, just a quick shunt out of Paddington.
It's 12 noon on Monday, the 18th of July, 1898. Walter Peart and Harry Dean arrive to sign on for the day's shift. Walter is almost as senior as you can get, a second-class driver. Not quite top link, to use the jargon, but that final step is not far off. He's actually classed as a spare man, meaning he's required to run goods, passenger or special trains of any kind as the need arises. He's been in the railway service for over 23 years, 11 of them as a driver. Being a spare man, he has no regular engine of his own.
Harry is fireman first class. He's been with the company for 8 years and fireman for the last 7. It's quite probable that as a senior driver, Walter Peart has hand-picked Harry Dean as his colleague. Certainly they've been a team for the last 6 months. There has to be harmony and trust and silent understanding on the footplate, where communication by word of mouth is often made impossible by noise.
They were good men. Can't say I knew them that well. Harry was from Devon somewhere. Walt had been at Westbourne Park for under a year. Walter, he was at Didcot Shed before he transferred here. Oh, knew his trade, Walter. Railwayman, through and through. Walter and Harry were so proud to be part of God's wonderful railway.
July the 18th, and driver and fireman already know what the day's work is going to be. They were told 2 days ago. They look at the notice boards for details of signal alterations, permanent way restrictions, anything concerning their stretch of line. The depot's chief locomotive foreman, Alf Atwood.
I've rostered them out on the 1:05 p.m. Paddington-Windsor stopping train, back with the 4:15 stopping only once at Slough, and then a couple more round trips before finally returning to the sheds at 9:30 to sign off. A long day, but not that long by our standards, when a 12-hour shift is routine.
Owing to an engine failure, the two men have been assigned a rugged, no-nonsense replacement engine. Worthy and not a bit glamorous, despite its copper-topped chimney and brass dome and safety valve cover. It's really a freight engine, number 238, a 30-year-old veteran built in the renowned GWR shops at Swindon.
Walter and Harry would have gone to the stores to supply themselves with the oil, cotton waste and other material which they'd need for the day's work. Walter would have satisfied himself that the right amount of coal was in the tender, examined all the springs, tested the set bolts, got his long feeder oil can with its spout like a curlew's beak, and gone round the engine making sure that all the various working parts of the 238 were well lubricated. Harry, meanwhile, would have got the keys of the toolboxes from the office and put out the various tools needed for the trip. Then would have tested the water gauge to see that it was working properly, had a good look at the fire, which would have needed to be watched, the coal well distributed to burn with maximum efficiency. You see, cost effectiveness is a watchword on the railways today, and there's a bonus paid to crews who use as little fuel as possible. Next, Harry would have examined the smoke box to see that it was shut tightly. He checked the sand boxes. They must be full of dry sand, ready to be funneled down onto the track if the rails are slippery. Then he satisfied himself that the ash pan was properly cleaned out and the tender full of water.
There were no problems, apparently. 238 was, by all accounts, in fine fettle. It had been overhauled under a year ago, and Walter knows that it ran to and from Henley the day before on one of the so-called Red Lion Express weekend special trains, taking day trippers down to the river on cheap away-day-style tickets. These specials are heavy and quite fast trains, and 238 did the job.
Anyway, these locomotives regularly run non-stop on 80-mile routes, working much more exacting freight trains at speeds of around 50 miles per hour.
So, on the fatal day, no one is concerned that 238 is a replacement for the rusted engine, which happens to have failed at Trowbridge and is stranded there.
Paddington, 12:45 p.m. and a special train carrying the cabinet of Lord Salisbury's government down to Windsor for an audience with Queen Victoria gets underway. On the next platform, Harry Dean checks his fire, cleans it, breaks up any clinker, spreads the white-hot coals evenly around the firebox, and puts some good-sized lumps into the back corners so that the fire will shake down nicely into the grate with the motion of the engine once they're up and running down the main line.
Piat is talking to William Jarrett, the guard, who's telling him how many carriages make up the 105 departure and what the total weight is. Walt has already tested the vacuum brake, and everything seems in order.
The trip down to Windsor is slow and uneventful. They arrive on time at 2 p.m, uncouple their engine, and travel back light to Slough to turn it around. Next comes the routine of replenishing the tender with water, trimming the coal, and checking for hot axle boxes, a major cause of breakdowns on engines, carriages, and goods trucks.
As Walter goes round 238, all looks absolutely normal. There's no way he can detect a fatal flaw in the inside connecting rod.
Time to put their feet up in the loco men's mess before once again they back down to the station and wait for the right away from Windsor on the 4:15 semi-fast to Paddington, due in at 4:47. After stopping at Slough, some hard running is required if they're going to complete the journey to time, especially as the 11-coach load isn't a light one. But journey's end for Walter Peart and Harry Dean came at 4:40, just after Acton Station.
The Times. The accident to a Great Western engine. The driver and stoker were overwhelmed by fire and steam, but although shockingly burned and scalded, they remained at their posts and succeeded in bringing the train to a standstill.
The Acton Press. It appears that the connecting rod of the engine had broken, with the result that at each revolution of the wheel, the broken end pierced the casing of the boiler and firebox. A violent explosion followed, a mass of steam, fire, cinders and piping being thrown out. The driver and fireman received the full force of the explosion in their faces, the steam and red-hot cinders inflicting frightful injuries. Fortunately, they retained their self-possession, applied the brake, and by other means tried to stop the engine. They did not succeed immediately, however, the train having just cleared the station before it came to a standstill. For the space of 200 yards, the men seemed to have faced the fire of steam and cinders issuing from the boiler, manfully standing to their places and doing their best to stop the train. But before the railway station was reached, they were either forced off the engine, or the limit of human endurance having been reached, they fell off.
Imagine an express train, travelling at a rate of 50 miles per hour, having sped through Ealing, suddenly left to its own guidance, just at the point where signals begin to get thick and the utmost vigilance in approaching Westbourne Park is needed. This was the thought that must have passed through Peart's mind upon realising what had happened by the sound of the beating bar of steel as it plunged again and again into the boiler, working havoc at each stroke. A driver's hand is never off the levers in these days of high speed, and Peart would have instantly shut off the steam valve and applied both brakes before he thought of himself. Meanwhile, clouds of steam were scalding him and the fireman to death.
My name's Edmund Mears, a plate layer on the section of the line which includes Acton. I was working there at the time of the incident. I heard the train approaching, but I didn't see it. Before it came into view, there were two loud reports and the hissing of a dense volume of steam. When the train stopped, I ran down the line and jumped on the footplate, but both the driver and the fireman were missing. I got down off the engine and ran back along the track for a short distance beyond the end of the train and found the men lying there.
Hodges. John Hodges. I'm a plate layer in the employ of the GWR, like Mr. Mears. I was also working on the track at Acton. After the train stopped, I saw the two men lying on the ground. I helped put them in the brake van of the train and we set off. The driver asked me as he lay there, "Where am I?" And I answered, "At Acton." He said, "I thought so. Is my face cut much?" "Yes, it is, old boy." The driver said, "Never mind. I stopped my train." "How did you stop it?" "I put the brake on." The driver talked all the way to Westbourne Park. He said, "I've got no bones broken." He didn't tell me anything about the accident. He then asked me, "Where is my poor mate?" And I said, "He's behind. They're bringing him along now." He asked, "Is he hurt much?" To which I replied, "I'm afraid he is, old boy." He said, "Poor fellow." He took a rest for a while. Then he looked at me and said, "I stuck to my engine." "Did you not jump off?" I asked. Mr. Peart said, "No. When it happened first, I got back out of the way, and then the train seemed to be going as fast as ever. So I went back to put on the vacuum brake. Then, as I was going back again, my foot struck the connecting rod."
The Times. At Paddington, an ambulance arrived, and a staff of local ambulance men rendered every assistance. The injured men were speedily transferred to St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. Legg, the house surgeon, immediately attended to their injuries. Walter Peart was seriously burned on the face and hands and was badly cut in several places. On Monday it was hoped he might pull through, although he was then in a precarious condition.
The Acton Press. The fireman was in an even more critical condition. His face and head were very severely burned and cut all over, and both his arms and legs were fearfully injured. On Monday night, he was very restless, and his condition gave the greatest anxiety.
Several of the passengers from the train made straight for the hospital, when they eventually got to Paddington, to inquire after the two engine men. Many left their names and addresses with the railway authorities, asking to be informed of developments and offering help in whatever shape or form.
One distinguished passenger was the Right Honourable G.J. Goschen, the First Lord of the Admiralty, returning from an audience with the Queen. Presumably he'd travelled down earlier in the day on the Cabinet Special, just ahead of Walter and Harry. He later sent the railway company a letter expressing his high sense of the self-sacrificing devotion of the fireman and engine driver.
I came to my husband Walter's bedside that Monday night. He was conscious and he recognised me. It was piteous to see him. All the skin was gone from his face and hands, and most of his hair had burned away too. He was so uncomfortable and restless, and he would keep saying over and over, "I saved her, Ada. I saved her." I wanted to touch him, tried to make it a bit easier for him, but he was in too much distress. And the nurses said I should just sit still and leave him be. That was best. Walter. Walter, you poor man. What am I going to tell the children? What is to become of us?
Miraculously, the coaches from the train were quite undamaged. Nobody was even slightly hurt among the passengers. But for the two engine men, a terrible night followed. Walter's agony lasted until around 6 o'clock on the Tuesday morning, Harry's 3 or 4 hours more. The cause of death, later recorded on Walter's death certificate, shock and exhaustion, scalds by steam from engine which was pierced by piece of connecting rod which broke from a flaw in it. Accidental.
Shock and exhaustion. Probably shorthand for 50% or 60% burns, producing massive fluid loss and kidney failure, and what's called blast lung, when the lung tissue is destroyed as a result of a violent explosion, the sort of injury that causes huge numbers of fatalities in modern warfare. What a dreadful night those two must have endured. Mercifully, they'd been given large doses of pain-killing laudanum, and the nurses would have covered them in dressings of soothing oil, giving at least some relief.
Wherefore aeolian music down the line sings for your souls a requiem today, and every sobbing engine calls us back to that last cry we heard upon the track, greater than human, when in power divine you saved our lives but cast your own away.
The events of July the 18th were relived at the inquest, held by Dr. Danford Thomas at Marylebone Coroner's Court on Friday, the 22nd of July, 1898, only 4 days after the accident.
Please tell the court your name and address and state your relationship to the deceased.
Ada Jane Peart. I live at 2 Kensal Place, Harrow Road, London. I'm the wife of Walter Peart. I identified his body in St. Mary's Hospital. He was 42 years old.
Thank you. Now, you, sir, would you kindly do the same?
Henry Dean, cabinet maker, resident of Dawlish in Devon. I am the father of fireman Henry Dean, and I identified his body. He was 25 years old, married, and resided at 29 Alberton Street, Queen's Park, London.
On behalf of all assembled here and of the directors of the Great Western Railway Company, the court wishes to express its deep regret to the bereaved families for this most unfortunate occurrence. The deceased were men of exemplary character, and they appear to have met their deaths through devotion to duty by standing with great bravery on the footplate under circumstances of the utmost danger to themselves. A serious accident has been avoided. These two men remembered what was due to the passengers under their charge. Please call the guard of the train.
My name is William Jarrett. I was the guard in charge of the train in question. Every day for 1 week in three I was in charge of that service. I knew the driver, Walter Pitt, but not the fireman. The train passed Southall to time. After passing Acton West Box, I noticed a volume of steam enveloping the train. I looked out but saw nothing. I felt the heat and thought we had rushed into a fire. Hearing a crackling sound, I was about to apply the vacuum brake and found it was already on. We were going at a good speed, from 50 to 55 miles an hour. The train pulled up in about 400 yards, about 100 yards after passing Acton Station. I went to the engine and a plate layer called out, "They're both gone," meaning that the men had left the engine. The engine was quiet. I ran back to the station and called out that there had been an accident, and seeing some men go to the assistance of the deceased with a stretcher, I went to the signal box to stop other trains. Then I went to prevent my passengers from alighting. I found that there had been an explosion, but I didn't know exactly what had occurred until afterwards. Eventually, we had another train and went on to London.
Thank you. Mr. John Armstrong, please.
I'm Divisional Superintendent of the Locomotive and Carriage Department, Paddington. I examined engine 238. It was built in 1867 and has been renewed since that time with new boilers and other items. The connecting rod in question is examined by the driver every time the engine is used, both when he takes it out and brings it in. It's the inside right-hand connecting rod. After the accident, the engine was taken to Westbourne Park. It ran along the line all right. The severed end of the rod had broken its way through the two plates of the firebox, between which is the water space. The outside crank possibly caught the driver by the legs and knocked him off. To my knowledge and in my experience, we've only had one other breakage of the inside rod in 15 years.
The internal flaw is very apparent in this broken section. Please show the rod to the juryman.
The rod is about 6 feet long and 2.5 inches thick by 4 inches deep.
For your benefit, gentlemen, I have a diagram. It shows that the connecting rod runs from the steam cylinder to the axle of the driving wheels. It must therefore move at high speeds with a to and fro motion, taking the drive to the wheels. It is a vital component.
The flaw would have been indiscoverable when the rod was whole.
I understand these things, and no man could have detected it. Does its having been in use for so long injure it?
Yes, it's difficult to know when the flaw came there. It might have been in the manufacture or it might have opened.
Such a thing might exist for a long time without it being discovered from the outside?
Yes, it may have been going on for 10 years.
Oh. This was what you know on the line as a goods engine?
Yes.
Yet on the day in question, it was used to run an express passenger train?
Yes.
Was there any special examination of the engine before it was put to that work?
The regular examination before it goes out. These engines are capable of running fast trains and are doing so constantly.
How long is it since the new boiler was put in?
I cannot say.
Was anything else done?
It will have had new boilers, new wheels, new tyres and very likely new rods.
And very likely not. Is there any other examination except by the eye?
Oh, yes. There are examinations by sounding and by a very powerful glass.
That is the test at Swindon?
Yes, it is.
Do you say that this engine was suitable for this kind of train?
Yes. It was built both for this purpose and for heavier trains as well. It's capable of doing 50 or 60 miles an hour. This train was only timed for 46 miles an hour.
How was it that this engine came to be used on that day?
It was used with the train because another engine had failed.
In point of fact, it had never been used for that train before.
Oh, yes, I have no doubt it had been used.
What work had it been doing recently?
It had been on the Henley specials.
What is its regular work? Heavy loads?
Yes, and fast Exeter expresses.
You would call it an obsolete engine nowadays for express trains?
It depends on what you call express trains. We should not think of putting it to the Flying Dutchman, for instance, but this was not really an express, but a local train.
The overall weight of the train would affect the strain on the rod to some extent?
Yes.
Is there any reason why this engine should not have been used on this train?
None whatever.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. That is all.
The jury was instructed that it had the whole case before it. After a brief interval for deliberation, it returned and handed the coroner its written verdict.
Death from an accidental cause.
We also wish to place on record our high appreciation of the conduct of the two deceased men in applying the brake and keeping at their posts, thus probably averting a serious catastrophe and danger to the lives of the passengers of the train.
The jury also remarked, apparently against Mr. Armstrong's expert evidence, that the said engine was not a fit and proper one to be used for drawing express trains.
I do not see that this remark by the jury can be justified. I know my engines. I know what they can do. 238's really what you'd call a mixed traffic locomotive, passenger as well as goods. It was built by Swindon. It's been regularly overhauled by Swindon. To my way of thinking, there's no finer praise, no more need be said. Swindon men are the best trained engineers and fitters in the land. No, I'd say in the world. And they're loyal and happy workers. The Great Western looks after its people properly. All railway men know that, whatever company they're with. Swindon is the benchmark. 238 was properly maintained, and it was quite suitable for the 415 Windsor, not really an express, no. The flaw in that connecting rod was only 3 inches long, and it was right at the heart of the metal. No one could have detected it. The coroner himself said he understood that. How it got there in the first place, the Lord only knows. When it was manufactured in Germany, that's the likely explanation. If we'd made it ourselves at Swindon. A 3-inch bubble of air separating two men from their deaths.
The accident was a sad and unfortunate business for John Armstrong. He'd been unfairly criticised at the coroner's inquest for allowing 238 to operate the Windsor semi-fast. They were looking for scapegoats, really. And Armstrong was right to be proud of Swindon. Its equipment was constantly updated, and the best tools and appliances anywhere in the world were to be found at Swindon, as a matter of course. The machine tools were capable of operating to a thousandth of an inch.
But the nation couldn't help feeling that faulty workmanship had led to the deaths of the two men. Their funerals became major public expressions of mourning for two dedicated railwaymen. Dean was taken back to his hometown of Dawlish, a town wrapped in dark sorrow.
The parents of the deceased, Henry Dean, wished to have their son buried at Dawlish, and for this purpose the body was conveyed from London to this town by the train reaching here at 2:19, the remains of the unfortunate young man being accompanied by his father. The mournful procession started from the railway station soon after 3 o'clock, and the coffin was preceded by over 60 tradesmen and other inhabitants of the town. When the funeral cortege reached the London Hotel, the mournful strains of the beautiful Dead March in Saul floated in the air and gave a thrilling effect to the solemn scene. And not until the whole length of the Strand had been traversed did the band cease to play its tribute to the heroic dead. Very touching indeed was the service, and many a tear fell from the eyes of those who had known Dean when he lived amongst us. But to know him was to like him. Among the wreaths which were received was one with a card on which was written, "A token of much sympathy and respect in memory of the brave Mr. Dean, Duchess of Rutland." A floral harp was sent by the engineman of the Great Northern Railway Company. At the evening service at St. Mark's Church, the preacher, in the course of his remarks, said,
"We are thinking today of a most honourable action done by one of our Dawlish men, and we feel proud of him and his action. If we were asked what we thought of it, we should say it was a glorious deed. He was a hero on earth, and will be one in paradise."
The Great Western Magazine, August 1898. We are reminded of how tenderly the lines of Tennyson are fitted for such as them. "Not once or twice in our old island story, the path of duty is the way to glory."
If Dean's burial was a Devon affair, Walter Peart's, 2 days later, was metropolitan. It even had something of a national event about it.
The Daily Telegraph. "A remarkable demonstration of public sympathy was witnessed in London yesterday upon the occasion of the interment of Walter Peart. The proceedings partook of the nature of a public funeral, and most affecting were the scenes enacted at the graveside in the vicinity of which a vast concourse of sympathisers had congregated.
The Acton Press. It was shortly before 3 o'clock when the carriages, generously provided free of charge by Mr. Lucy, drew up in front of the house in Kensal Place. And by this time the crowd had assumed imposing dimensions, leaving scarce an inch of unoccupied ground in the narrow roadway.
Slowly the chief mourner's coaches, which were drawn by 2 horses, made their way to the cemetery gates. And in their wake, bareheaded and stricken with sorrow, walked 6 comrades of the dead man, to whom had been assigned the privilege of bearing his body to the graveside. Among the floral offerings was the one sent to the bereaved widow by the Duchess of Rutland, with the words, "In much respect and sympathy for the memory of the brave railwayman."
So vast were the throngs that followed the cortege that it was not deemed advisable by the cemetery officials to admit all who sought admittance. And in this way, not a little disappointment, perchance inevitable, was occasioned.
2 hymns were sung, the first being "Thy Will Be Done," and the second, which was given out at the close of this part of the rites, "Sleep on, beloved, sleep, and take thy rest." At the graveside, the minister took occasion to say a few words by way of a brief funeral oration.
Lives like his are glorious. And it is well to live in a land that gives birth to such men and appreciates their valour and their self-sacrifice. This good man and his noble mate met their fate like the immortals of Balaclava, riding through the valley of death. I will express my fervent hope that the people of this country, who never fail to admire noble deeds and chivalrous actions, will not suffer the widow and family of this brave fellow who has sacrificed his life at duty's shrine to go in want.
With such words as these, words that went straight to the hearts of all to whom they were addressed, came to a close the memorable proceedings that saw Walter Peart, engine driver, and one of England's heroes, laid to his eternal rest.
I can scarcely believe it's true even now. I'm always fancying that he's going to come back to me. I don't feel brave, but I suppose I'm just going to have to be. What's going to happen now? What sort of future have we got? I never dreamed that he'd go like this. The other wives get frightened, a lot of them. A driver's life is nasty and dangerous. The company doesn't believe in putting proper protection on its engines. Those men stand out there where anything can get at them. They're denied shelter in case they doze off or miss the signals. That's what I've heard. But I never once thought this would happen to him.
Mrs. Ada Peart is a brave woman. The sudden blow prostrated her with grief, but she has nerved herself up to face the future. She is keenly appreciative of the public sympathy manifested in so many forms. In her little home, soon to be broken up, the fresh mourning of the children appeals to one so strongly, and the empty chair at the head of the table tells its own tale. Upon the wall of the little sitting room in Kensal Place is a framed certificate.
The Great Western Company gave Walter that in 1875 when he was first registered as a fireman at Didcot. Oh, well, I should have liked to keep the family together, but I've made some plans. I should be able to manage financially, just. Walter's pay was 7 shillings and 6 pence a day and quite a few extras too, so we did live nicely. What I'd like to do when I've taken measures for all the children is rent my mother's house from her. Well, she lives near the engine shed. Well, then I could let out lodgings to double home railwaymen. You see, I understand their ways, and my husband was well known. A double home man is the driver whose work takes him, say, 2 nights away from where he lives, and therefore he needs lodgings. These I should provide.
But her keenest anxiety at the present moment pertains to the uncertainty which attaches to the career of her eldest son.
Walter is 16 years old, has been a pupil teacher for 1 year under the school board, and will be in receipt until July next of an allowance, which is little more than sufficient to buy his books and pay occasional tram fares. Provided he secures a Queen's scholarship, he will be competent to enter college, and for the space of 2 years, whilst the training is completing, he will not be a burden to me, apart from the college entrance fees of £15 to £20. Sissy, that's my eldest, she's been serving in a shop, but she may decide to become an undernurse. She's very fond of children. I've had an offer of help for 2 of my boys through Mr. Armstrong.
A gentleman has said that he'll place Ernest and Sydney in the Alexandra Orphanage. They're ready to go. I shall accept. I shall then have my youngest girl, Daisy. I can't let her go. I must keep her.
The Daily Telegraph. Mrs. Peart has no idea of embarking upon what is usually the forlorn hope of widows, a general shop, and her little capital will therefore not be risked in such a venture. What her means may be, she does not know. That the Workmen's Compensation Act would entitle her to probably £300 was a surprise to her. Apart from this, the benefit societies to which her husband belonged will pay her £40 as a widow's allowance and £18 and £5 in death grants. She also expects to receive 4 shillings a week from another railway fund to which her husband subscribed.
There were also several GWR benefit funds available which the families of the two men might expect to come to their rescue. The Providence Society started in 1838, the Locomotive Department Sick Fund, the Great Western Railway Medical Fund Society, the Mutual Assurance Sick and Superannuation Society, founded in 1865, and finally, there was the Salaried Staff Widows and Orphans Pension Society, which should have been tailor-made for the victims of the Acton accident, had Walter and Harry not been debarred from it for not being in a sufficiently exalted grade of company employees.
I don't want to go back up to London. I can't stay in that house now, Harry. I want to be with my family here in Dawlish. I'm a Devon girl. I'll stay on after my baby's born and my mother will take care of us. I've got all my friends here. It weren't like that in London. It was lonely. I don't understand city folks' ways. I haven't got any reason to stay up there anymore.
The Daily Telegraph. The confinement of Mrs. Eliza Dean, the fireman's widow, is so close at hand that the effects of the shock and of the travelling were regarded with apprehension. Mrs. Dean, it is estimated, will receive in compensation £200 and £40 as her widow's allowance, together with about 4 shillings a week, so long as she does not marry again.
The men at the Westbourne Park Locomotive Depot opened their own subscription. There was a suggestion that some of the money raised should be expended in floral emblems of mourning, but Divisional Superintendent John Armstrong advised that it would be better used to give it directly to the bereaved. Throughout that summer of 1898, donations of all sizes flowed into appeal offices, sent in mainly from Britain, but also from abroad.
Sir, I have only this day seen an account of the plucky action of those English engine drivers, Peart and Dean. In the name of my wife and myself, I have pleasure in sending a cheque for £5, 5 shillings for their families. Other countries may outbuild us in ships, but anyway, we seem still to continue breeding men who are men. Yours faithfully, C.J. Cutliffe Hine, Hotel Royal, Ulster, Italy.
Sir, I have much pleasure in enclosing you 35 shillings, which amount I have collected at the lunch table of the Crichton Club towards the fund you are raising. Yours faithfully, Sidney Bartram.
Sir, enclosed is a postal order for the widows and orphans of the railway heroes from one who knows the widow's sorrow, the Lansdowne Hotel, Cork.
As an English schoolboy, I should like to send, as I'm extremely interested in English railways, especially the Great Western Railway, 2 shillings to the fund. I remain yours truly, J.F. Reed.
I shall be glad if you will kindly add the enclosed sum of 8 shillings to the fund, collected yesterday at Leighton during the Essex v Kent match. Yours obediently, a sympathiser.
When I first saw the account of the accident in your paper and the words Peart and Ealing in close conjunction, I thought it was something about myself, being the only Peart in Ealing. I sent a small subscription and hope that every other Peart will do the same and the Deans follow suit. Yours obediently, H.J. Peart.
The nation had taken the two men to their hearts.
The contributions flowed in, the accumulated total reaching £1,303, 8 shillings and 9 pence. A huge sum of money by today's standards. Trust funds were established for both families. Even man's most faithful friend was enlisted in the drive to raise money.
We have a new supporter in the person of famous collecting dog Jim at Slough Station. His owner, ticket collector Wardle, wrote to Paddington and asked whether Jim might collect for a fortnight. Permission was given and the dog is now collecting for that purpose.
More than 90 years after the accident, Harry Dean's resting place has weathered better than Walter Peart's in the grime of London. Harry's neat and well-tended grave lies towards the top of a gentle slope in the high part of Dawlish Cemetery, within sound of the sea and the birds. Walter's, though, is rather the worse for wear in the systematic repetition of leaning and disabled headstones in God's huge acreage at Kensal Green.
Ironically, not all that many rows away from Walter's grave stands an imposing vault, light-coloured, and conspicuously well-kept among the down-and-out masonry, keeling over in the rank grass. Its large and simple headstone bears the name of Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Steam and fire and dread and anguish. Yet the Britons must and will, rising over all triumphant, nerved them to be faithful still. Through the veil of death they thundered, at the mouth of hell they stood, till had passed the hour of danger, and was stemmed the fiery flood. Then and only then the heroes left their post, and never yet in our crown of heroism brighter jewel e'er was set. Aye, in spite of day's commercial and the love of golden gain, in the Briton's blood undaunted runs the old heroic strain.
Finally, their memory also lives on in a curious little monument put up a few years after the accident.
Under the skirts of St. Paul's Cathedral hides one of London's lesser-known public gardens, Postman's Park. Here is a series of commemorative plaques made of Doulton pottery, all dedicated to Victorian heroes and heroines of humble life. Among the 47 tributes on their polished tiles is this one.
Walter Peart, driver, and Harry Dean, fireman, of the Windsor Express, on July 18, 1898, whilst being scalded and burnt, sacrificed their lives in saving the train.
The story of Walter Peart and Harry Dean is one of undoubted bravery. But the irony is that probably they didn't need to fight back through the flames to wrestle with the engine's brakes. Improved technology ensured that the train's automatic vacuum braking system was applied the moment the boiler burst and ruptured the brake lines. But what they knew instinctively was that they had an obligation to their passengers and that they must not think of themselves until the train was stopped. They died in the belief that they had saved their train.
I tell the tale in words of gold. Go spread it far and wide. From east to west, from north to south, tell how two brave men died. Two men of England, sons of toil, a stoker and his mate, who, for the sake of other lives, have met a hero's fate. Such men as these have nations made, have built a country's fame, men worthy to be kings of men, all honored be their name. Until the Britain's race is o'er, the memory, Lord, keep green, of engine driver Walter Peart and stoker Harry Dean.
Martin Jarvis and Joanna Myers recounted the story of Walter Peart and Harry Dean in Nevermind, I Stopped My Train by Martin Sorrell. Ada Peart, Anne Windsor, Eliza Dean, Cyril Jenkins, David Evans, Peter Penry Jones, Alf Atwood and the coroner, John Church, Edmund Mears and William Jarrett, Nicholas Murchie, John Hodges, Jonathan Taffler, and John Armstrong, John Webb. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The director was Martin Jenkins.